Hello, and welcome to Controversies in Church History, the podcast that takes you into the most important, interesting, but controversial events in the history of the Roman Catholic Church. Welcome again. My name is Derek Taylor, your host for the podcast. Thank you, everyone who listens to the podcast. Really appreciate it. If you're listening for the first time, welcome. I hope you enjoy the podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you can go to our website. It's churchcontroversies.com. Had some more explanation about who I am, links to other things, links to my writings in Crisis Magazine and other places. I also find us social media, Facebook, YouTube. I'm on Twitter, usually posting meaningless things occasionally. I don't do a whole lot there, but I have an account for the podcast, as well as those are the main ones. But go like our Facebook page if you would. Subscribe on YouTube. I post the podcast there. I'm trying to increase the members there. It's growing slightly on there, but let people know about the podcast if you like it. We're hosted by Spotify. You can find us on Apple Podcast, Castbox, Google Play, Google Podcasts, all these other places should be there. We are free. All these are free. You can, if you want, become a patron of the podcast. We have a Patreon page. Just if you want, it basically gives you early access. I'm going to start doing some more special episodes for patrons. And by the way, thank you to our two new patrons. This is the first podcast since we've got two of them. Kevin Hogarty of Kansas City, my former home, and Spencer Hess. I want to thank you guys for contributing. Very humbled by it, blessed by it. Hopefully it'll be worth your while. If you want to do that, again, not necessary, but appreciate it. Does help grease the wheels. And you can find the podcast pretty much anywhere. If you do that, if you go to Patreon and do that, you'll get stuff sooner. Couple weeks, a few days actually, maybe you'll be getting another podcast become available to everybody. Usually drop them earlier for patrons. Done a couple of special episodes for patrons only, trying to line up interviews. It's coming. The interviews will come, and I swear to God, we'll do a live stream at some point. I'm trying to get a friend of mine to go to all this with me, who's an apologist. I'm not an apologist, but it might be helpful to have somebody like that on here, but we'll do that soon as well. So I'm trying to reach out to you guys a little bit more. Again, thank everyone for listening. Appreciate it. So this is a new episode. This is a newish episode. I'm not sure. I think I'm going to leave this up here. I think it is kind of a new version of an old episode, and I have been re-recording older episodes where the sound quality wasn't good because I was giving them as informal talks instead of reporting them as a podcast originally. And this episode, I've given a different title. It's a similar topic. I've called it Galileo's Ghost, The Trial of Galileo and the Myth of Expertise, or the Modern Myth of Expertise, I should say. And so we're going to talk about the Galileo trial in this episode, go through some of the stuff. If you don't know the background to this, we'll talk about what we think we're probably talking about here, which is, this is the great sort of event that's often used against the Catholic Church. It's opposed to science. There's science deniers or whatever. But also something else, which I'll get to in a second. But having thanked everybody and everything, what are we talking about here? Galileo's Ghost. Well, we're talking about something like this. If you recall Humanae Vitae, the encyclical issued by Pope Paul VI in 1968, which reaffirmed the Church's teaching that artificial contraception is immoral. There was, of course, a huge firestorm of controversy against this. Most people, a lot of people in the Church and outside wanted the Church to change its teachings. And there was a backlash, even among bishops in the world. And one of the leaders of this opposition to it was Cardinal Sunens of Belgium. Cardinal Sunens had been a progressive one of the progressive leaders at the Second Vatican Council. He had been trying to convince the Pope earlier to alter the teaching, to make exceptions for it. And when Humanae Vitae was issued, he issued a public statement in reaction to it, in which he addressed his fellow bishops. And he said this, quote, "I beg you, my brothers, let us avoid another Galileo affair. One is enough for the Church," unquote. So what was he talking about? Why would he mention the Galileo affair with regards to contraception? Well, of course, the idea is that modern science has told us that contraception is just fine. Therefore, the church changed the teaching. And he is mentioning it. Other people, by the way, before the council, people like Joseph Ratzinger were worried about that sort of thing. The church was behind the times, and if you're behind the times, you'll be seen as silly and stupid by the great and good. And quite frankly, the church has been terrified by this type of scandal ever since. The invention of the printing press has made it possible to exploit things like this, whether these things were real scandals or imagined ones. But I'd say the biggest one in the leaders of the church's mind, as you can just hear, has been the Galileo affair. It's played an outsized role both in the church's imagination and the wider world for a long time. If you don't know, I did an episode on the church's stance on evolution a while back. And one of the things you learn in there, and I learned by doing the podcast, was the church handled the evolutionary question with really delicate hands, mainly because they were terrified of another Galileo situation. And of course, this has become the sort of myth, one of the founding myths of modernity. In some ways, it's the just-so story of modernity. If you know what a just-so story is, it's an unfalsifiable story or narrative that's supposed to explain something about human society or human life or cultural traits. And of course, at the time when Galileo was condemned by or forced to recant his views by the Inquisition in the 1630s, this became fodder for people like Voltaire to portray it as anti-science. Voltaire helped propagate one of the great myths about Galileo, that he'd been tortured by the Inquisition. There's no evidence he was tortured by the Inquisition, by the way. We'll get into that in a second. And of course, later on, you have, especially in the 19th century, this fed into a larger narrative about the war between science and religion. This is especially associated with anti-Catholic writers like John William Draper. He wrote a book called The Conflict Between Science and Religion, and Galileo featured, of course, in this book. Is one of these main things. You, of course, there's a famous legend that as Galileo, after he had been forced to recant his position that the earth was moved around the sun, that he said, allegedly had said, and yet it moves, referring to the sun. This was never mentioned at the time. That legend is first repeated in 1757 by an Italian writer named Giuseppe Baretti. It's repeated in the 19th century by people like Giuseppe Mazzini, who was a revolutionary who was, fighting against the church. And this sort of fable has become repeated endlessly that, Galileo was the, courageous truth seeker who was, use contemporary terms, canceled by the church. And so this becomes, a feature of modern life. And what I'm going to suggest in this version of this talk, and I've given this talk before, actually used to be a lecture of mine when I taught Western Civ courses, but I'm going to put this a little bit different story here, frame this differently for you, because it is about this, and we'll talk about that, the religion versus science thing, but I'm going to put it in these terms. As a problem of expertise, that's the subtitle of this episode, and I'm specifically thinking of, again, you have the expertise of Galileo in science, but you have, of course, religion, right? The people he was fighting with, a lot of them were scientists, but they were also clergy, and they were also experts, they were theologians, and this is partly what the myth of modernity is supposed to tell you, right? That those people don't have expertise. Religion is unreal, there's nothing there, listen to us, we have specialized expertise. But you're going to find there's even something more going on here, and in terms of not just religious, expertise versus scientific, if you want to put it in those terms, but between specialist expertise versus a generalist idea of expertise. And I'll explain what I mean by the end of that. I'll set that up for you so you can see this as we go forward. And how this is one of the reasons why you can make the argument the church actually had the better of things in the Galileo affair. And by the way, if that sounds shocking to even to a Catholic, that's because it's kind of funny. You have scholars of this event know a lot of these things are myths. And they publish books about it all the time. There was a book published about 10 years ago called Galileo Goes to Jail and Other Myths About Religion and Science. it has no effect on the popular view of this. It doesn't affect anything. It doesn't really matter how many monographs people publish saying that, well, Galileo, and we'll talk about some of the things Galileo got wrong in this. I'm not going to dwell too much on the specific science. I'm not a scientist, but a little bit on the stuff just to make the point. But it doesn't seem to penetrate people's minds. And I'm going to try to explain why and why we should think about it very differently. And so just to begin, just the background of this is all part of what was called the scientific revolution, right? I'm not going to belabor this too much, but suffice it to say, I'm not going to belabor this, but there was science before the 17th century. Is it science the way we consider it? Probably not. It was, in fact, they didn't use that term natural science. That term wouldn't be used in the 1830s. They talked about natural philosophy, which they opposed to natural history, if this is getting all confusing. But natural history had to do with the observation and classification of plants and animals, with particulars. What philosophy, natural philosophy, meant for them, what they thought was really, truly scientific, which gave true knowledge, was concerned with the principles of nature, right? That told you about the larger patterns of nature rather than its actual individual measurable quantities. Principles rather than facts, if you want to put it that way. So what happens, of course, with the scientific revolution is all this gets turned on its head. Science comes to mean the collection and gathering of observable, measurable data, right? This is the teaching of people like Sir Francis Bacon, the empiricist philosopher. It's picked up by actual real scientists like Robert Boyle in the 17th century in England, who do experiments on the basis of this idea. And Galileo is part of this. He's one of the people who transitioned us into the modern scientific world, a shift toward, you know, experimentation conducted by a methodology. And rather than seeing nature as a whole, it's something that you sort of observe bit by bit. And this changes things profoundly because it's a more holistic conception of what nature and the natural world is in that older view of it before the 16th and 17th centuries. And it's also much more, well, it becomes it's already specialist expertise, but it's a different type. And particularly with people I mentioned, Sir Francis Bacon, Robert Boyle, I'm not going to dwell on this too much. I talk about this more in the earlier edition of this, which I think I'll keep up. But in philosophical terms, people like René Descartes, right? The Cartesian philosophy, right? Which you probably know is the, you know, dualism, mind-body dualism. But he's also someone who argues for what's sometimes called the mathematical turn in philosophy, that mathematics provides the model for real knowledge. And if you follow, you break up the world into its constituent parts, you know, follow a rigorous method, it'll give you predictive power over the external world. And this is a real crucial thing, as we're seeing Galileo's, again, one of the pioneers of this. The only things that are real that we can say about nature have to do with these things. And this, again, this is a very different conception of it than what prevailed previously. You know, previously, again, a lot of this had to do when you're talking about academic natural philosophy in the Middle Ages with Aristotle, going back to these big ideas about nature. And again, a lot of people, they did some, observation and things like that in the Middle Ages. It was not, by the way, there was science in the Middle Ages as they understood it. There have been, again, books published on this recently. One was called The Light Ages. I can't remember the guy's name, but it's about how you did have scientific work done in the Middle Ages. But broadly speaking, it's very different. It'll be changed by all this. And so you have not only, the modern science wasn't just the discovery of bare facts, it's the change of understanding as a whole about what the enterprise was. And, okay, how does this get us into Galileo and the church then? Well, of course, the church was a part of everything in the Middle Ages, and what's happening in the 16th, 17th centuries is all this is kind of breaking apart. There's the Reformation. There's the Catholic response to that, the Counter-Reformation, the Catholic Reformation, where the church is reformed, they become much more militant about defending its authority. This is a part of the story. There's, of course, the discovery of new knowledge, the discovery of the Americas and all these other things, you know, taking us beyond ancient boundaries of knowledge coming from the ancient world. And, of course, during all this, while this is going on, while Galileo was interrogated by the Inquisition, the 30 Years' War is going on, which is a sort of war, you know, for the soul of Europe in some way. So you have all these things calling things into question, which influences all this and influences the way the church sees things, because they see the entire world under attack as they understand it. And so to understand why they might have bigger, different concerns than Galileo is an important thing to think in those terms. Again, I won't belabor that. Talked about it more in an earlier version of this. So what about the actual debate? What about the whole idea of heliocentrism versus geocentrism? Again, you even say the word geocentrism, it sends giggles to your mouth, right? It's so ridiculous. Nobody believes that. It's hard to get back into that mindset because in the 16th century, that was the de facto worldview. And that worldview had sufficed for a long, long time for people in Western Europe. The Ptolemaic worldview, the idea that the Earth is located at the center of the universe and is static, doesn't move, the rest of the planets move around it, including the sun. And again, Ptolemy was a geometer, an astronomer who lived in Alexandria in Egypt in the 2nd century AD. Most of these ideas descend from him. They're based on the physics of Aristotle, though. And in Aristotle, he thought that, you know, unlike in our modern understanding, we understand all matter to be sort of one thing. There were different types of material, according to him. He separated the sublunar world, that is the Earth, from the superlunar world, the heavens. And according to Aristotle, the heavens were made up of a special material, which differed from the material that Earth was made of. The material was lighter and stronger in the heavens. The stuff on Earth, by the way, was garbage. I should mention that. There's, again, another myth that, you know, man thought he was the center of the universe because he was so good, and that's why his physical view of the physical universe put the Earth at the center. It's the opposite. The Earth was made of heavy, gross stuff that all fell to the bottom. And so it's kind of the opposite. Again, another one of these little myths here. And but in the main feature of this matter, as Aristotle had it, was its circular motion. And all the stars, by their nature, moved in circles. In Ptolemy's system, all the stars moved along spheres. And these spheres would revolve around the Earth. And each planet has a system of spheres along which it moves. And so so you have all this spherical motion going on, and the stars have a fixed place in these spheres. The spheres of these places revolve around the Earth and complete a revolution every 24 hours. And so you have this idea. And I mentioned, by the way, why all these circular motions? They didn't observe this. They just thought it was a good model, right? It was a perfect model because the circle is perfect, right? There's no beginning and no end. It has these very value-laden ideas built into it. But it was thought to be workable. And it did work, by the way, for the measuring techniques people had, for their view of the world. It did work. For 1,400 years, up until the 16th century, all the way from the ancient Greeks to the Muslims and Christians in the Middle Ages, they used the Ptolemaic system, made adjustments to it. But by the 15th century, some problems were becoming apparent with it. One was that a lot of these astronomers, and I need to qualify this here, astronomers was not a definite definition back then. Astrologers were taken to be astronomers as well. Mathematicians, if they had any knowledge of mathematics, they would be considered to be astronomers. None of them could agree, for example, on the order of the planets, you know, which ones were farther from the Earth and the Sun, all those sorts of things. So the clash of opinions. But the major one for our purposes, which drew the attention of early people we think as being, you know, modern scientists, was that it became difficult over time to square the motion of the planets with one of the basic premises of Aristotelian physics, which was that the planets move in a uniform way. Their motion is uniform along a fixed radius at a stable distance from the center of their motion. In other words, they don't move. They don't move farther away. They stay exactly the same. It's static. And Ptolemy had come up with a solution for this called equants. An equant is an imaginary point from which a planet can be seen to move uniformly. In other words, our reason why they look like these planets aren't moving in the right way or their distance because of our lack of a proper vantage point. But the problem with this solved that problem to a certain degree, but it contradicted the idea of a uniform motion, however, because a planet revolving around these quote-unquote equant points would still wobble. It would not be uniform motion anymore. And so it ruined the sort of perfection of the model. And so it couldn't quite keep up with actual observation, in other words. So by the early 16th century, you begin to have people looking at this. And the first one, of course, most famously, is Nicholas Copernicus, a Polish mathematician and astronomer. He's also a minor church official. He was a canon of a cathedral. And he turned to the heliocentric theory to overcome these problems in the 1540s. The idea that the sun is static and the Earth moves around it, the one we have today, to solve these problems. And he published his famous work on the Revolution of the Heavenly Spheres in 1543, just before he died. And this work is important. I mean, one of the things to note about his work is that it didn't really focus on the Bible at all, something that will become central with Galileo. He didn't really need to. Like, if you wanted to explain why, why the Bible literally didn't pick the heavens moving this way, you could just take, an allegorical reading of those passages in Scripture that seem to say that. The Christian church had long had that available to it as an explanation for why it didn't match up with scientific theories. What he focused on, however, was what was essentially the Aristotelian orthodoxy among early modern natural philosophers. That was what he was trying to get beyond. And in fact, he really couldn't prove his point at that point. Totally. He couldn't eliminate all the other options, but he did provide a single method for calculating the order of the planets and their distance from the sun. And the problem that it raised is, basically to do that, you'd have to ditch the entire Aristotelian philosophy on which all previous astronomy was based. This is the reason why, by the way, Copernicus's ideas weren't immediately accepted. It would mean throwing out everything people had already done, more or less. But he could, as he did, appeal to the simplicity and the harmoniousness of his model. It seemed to be fit together perfectly, right? Seems to make sense of things better. Later on, of course, there were other astronomers who took this up. Tycho Brahe was a Danish astronomer who, among other things, he observed from his laboratory in Denmark, Uraniborg. He made observations on a comet and a nova in the 1570s. And this was important, right? Because why? Comets and novas move. And of course, this contradicts the idea that the heavenly spheres are static and immutable. And yet, even he never abandoned Aristotle's physics totally. Instead, he didn't embrace heliocentrism. He embraced a compromise system, in which the planets orbited the sun, but the sun and the planets still orbited a stationary Earth. And this was adopted by a lot of people who weren't willing to jettison all these ideas well into the 17th century. And then finally, I'll mention him briefly before we get to Galileo. Another person who's an important part of this is Johannes Kepler. Whose theory of planetary motion was one of the keys for, again, explaining, how do these planets move? Again, I'm not going to go into this too much detail. I'm not a scientist, but the basic idea was planets didn't move in circles. Again, at this late day, everyone was still thinking in terms of circles. Why? Well, it seemed like a nice model. Or he came up with the idea that to explain how they might wobble or whatever, was they moved in elliptical orbits, not exact circles. And I should mention all this, by the way. Again, this is it took this long for not just people to listen to accept this Copernican theory, because of course you had all this all these institutions invested in the older theory because it had served so well for so long. People were just skeptical of throwing out everything in that regard. And I stress this, the biggest problem that most of these scientists faced, like Galileo, was not necessarily the church, it was Aristotelian philosophers who just wouldn't give it up. Which brings us to Galileo, end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century. He's a Florentine, he's from Florence, Italian. He works at the University of Pisa in the late 1580s, early 1590s. Becomes professor of mathematics at Padua, 1592 to 1610. And he becomes an astronomer. Actually, in his early years, he's working on motion. He's trying to replace Aristotle's view of motion with his based on Archimedes, sort of Archimedean principle of motion. And for better part of his career, he still adheres, up until 1609, he still adheres to the Ptolemaic worldview. What changes his mind was his work with the telescope. He begins working with the telescope in 1609 and quickly makes discoveries, make him famous, actually. He discovers new moons around Jupiter. He manages to prove, for example, because there were debates at this point, right? They didn't know you had this idea coming from Aristotle that the heavens were made of this perfect stuff. Well, now it's beginning to sort of, crumble. Okay, what are they made of up there? And so we don't know, for example, what the moon, it looks like something. And again, you can imagine we have perfect telescopes today. They didn't have, though. Even his got better as they went on. He didn't invent the telescope, but he made improvements. He eventually proves that the moon is not perfect. It has mountains on it because he made drawings from these images he saw, which, you know, displayed that they had shadows, right? So they were a certain height. So brilliant, you know, deduction. This is why scientists love Galileo. He's an inventor. He does stuff. But it also made it clear to him that the Copernican theory was probably true. And for the rest of his life, he tends to sort of work on this, as you'll see, even to a certain degree after his condemnation. And he begins defending it publicly. And that's when he begins to attract attention. It's also when he begins to attract enemies. And enemies, again, I should stress this, he had enemies pretty much everywhere, because, again, this was the dominant orthodoxy at the time. But he also attracted attacks by clerical opponents. And this is where the religion part comes in, because a lot of these people, were, of course, professors. There were, you know, mathematicians, what do you want to call them, early modern astronomers, who worked at the Vatican. The Pope had his own astronomers at his own court. And they didn't like the fact that he was basically saying, among other things, he was basically saying, well, he's going directly to say you couldn't take the Bible literally anymore is one of the things they were concerned about. But they were also proponents of the Aristotelian model. And you could make the case that, you know, a literal reading of the Bible fits in better with Aristotle. So this seemed to upset all of their ideas. It's possible, by the way, that they raised the hue and cry about, because they raised, let me be clear, in about 1613, you begin to have some of these clerics accusing Galileo of heresy. And it's possible they do this in order to defend their ideas. But it's also possible, and I'm suggesting this, they probably perhaps resented a layman treading on their turf, that is to say, their specialized expertise, which was theology, which Galileo had no choice but to do, to get rid of the Aristotelian theory. You kind of had to basically say this wasn't true, the literal reading, obviously, of for example, passages in the Bible where I believe Moses raises his hands and the sun stands still, stuff like that. And he defended himself in public, in letters, a couple of published letters, letter to a man named Castelli, letter to the Grand Duchess Christina, he took in the first instance, his stance on Scripture was that of St. Augustine's. You didn't need to take every passage literally, particularly when Scripture in question was more poetic, that, you know, Scripture was not a book of instructions or history. This was standard. This was something that goes back a long way. So he's more rooted in a traditional mindset there. People have made those arguments. And by the way, if you're wondering why people are taking more literally, because again, Copernicus didn't bank on a literal interpretation of the Bible at this in 1543. What's changed? Well, a couple of things have changed. The Inquisition was established in 1542, the Roman Inquisition, and of course, you've had the Counter-Reformation. People are a lot more aware of challenges to the church's authority, and they want to cut that stuff off. It probably made them a lot more defensive, particularly, of course, that's one of the charges of Protestants, the Catholics don't believe in the Bible. So all this seems to sort of, you know, be suspicious to some people, I guess, because especially if they're clerics. But moreover, in his published letters, he also argues that all the passages on the physical world in the Bible have to be determined first, their meaning, by natural philosophers. In other words, we can't go to a theologian first. We have to go to a natural philosopher. That's his domain. And moreover, the Bible doesn't tell us anything about scientific truth. It's only about faith and morals. What he's basically saying is that, in effect, his area of specialized expertise should prevail in matters about the natural world. Faith has nothing to teach us about the natural world. And the attacks on Galileo were severe. This was pretty knockdown, drag-off. I think there's a lot at stake here, right? People have vested their whole lives in the Ptolemaic system. They don't like seeing it attacked. And he gave as good as he got. I should mention this. If his critics accused him of heresy, however honestly or dishonestly, he accused them of using religion as a shield for bad arguments. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't think it's true. It doesn't sound like it's true of most of them. I think they were actually genuinely worried. It also, of course, was self-serving. But hey, those two things don't necessarily have to be, you know, something that offends both your personal interest, but also the interest of the institution you've dedicated your life to. They tend to go together pretty naturally. So, and again, this things happen. We have these type of polemics. You wonder about the motivations of people. But in 1615, things took a turn when a Dominican friar actually accused Galileo formally to the Inquisition. So in 1616, he was forced to go there and defend himself. And he had been defending himself in print. And I should mention, by the way, it's not as if people automatically, most of the scientists disagreed with him, actually. And there was a big debate about this. It wasn't like it was automatically every scientist was on his side. And he went there. There was a meeting of the Inquisition held at the home of his friend, actually, Cardinal Robert Bellarmine, Saint Robert Bellarmine. And he apparently intervened enough to get them to, not formally condemn him or anything. But they still issued an injunction in 1616, which basically forbade him to, I don't have it in my notes here, to hold and defend the idea that the earth moves and the sun remains still. I'll read the actual quote from you. This is from the injunction of the Holy Office of the Inquisition, 1616. To abandon completely the above-mentioned opinion that the sun stands still at the center of the world and the earth moves, and henceforth not to hold, teach, or defend in any way whatsoever, either orally or in written, otherwise they would start proceedings against him. And he agreed to this. Doesn't mean he couldn't defend it as a hypothesis. He could talk about it. He couldn't defend it directly. And in fact, they actually issued a decree banning. There was a guy named Foscarini who wrote a book or a pamphlet defending the Galilean system. It was condemned. And they actually ordered the suspension and rewriting of Copernicus's book to reflect all this. Did the Index of Prohibited Books, which is another invention of the Counter-Reformation. But Galileo was, he was being attacked by all these people. He actually got Bellarmine to give him a certificate, which basically declared that he had not been required to recant any of his views. He had been made to perform any penances, basically cleared him of being any suspicion of heresy or anything like that. And he had it in writing. We'll see, he produces this at his other trial in the 1630s. And so he cannot defend it now. He's still working on it in private. And he does take a slightly different tack. He begins doing things, talking about things like comets. Why would we talk about comets? Because again, comets are, they prove that the heavens move, obviously. And he wrote a book in 1623 called The Assayer, in which he makes some real, again, these are claims that are really bound up with the scientific revolution, and in which he famously proclaimed that nature had to be seen in terms of primary qualities. What are primary qualities? Primary qualities are things that can be measured mathematically, quantitatively. Basically, anything else beside those things aren't really real in terms of being something in the world out there. I'll read a passage. This is a passage from The Assayer. If something, quote, is white or red, bitter or sweet, noisy or quiet, and pleasantly or unpleasantly smelling, et cetera, these tastes, colors, odors are nothing but empty names. Rather, they inhere only in the sensitive body, such that if one removes the animal, then all these qualities are taken away and annihilated. In other words, secondary qualities like color, like taste, all these other sorts of things are secondary. They're not real. They're just things that we perceive, right? They're subjective, if you like. But the only things that are objective, to put it in those terms, are the mathematical measurements you make of these things. This is very crucial. He says, another famous passage, that that nature, quote, is written in mathematical language, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometrical figures. Without these, it is humanly impossible to understand a word of it. He means the book of nature. It's a phrase people used back then. And one wanders around pointlessly in a dark labyrinth. Only these can be the proper subject of scientific knowledge about the natural world. And this is one of the key things here. It's also a key to his claim to authority, because he's claiming to be an expert on this stuff. That same year it came out, his book. It was opposed, but it was also well-received. It was well-received particularly by one of his friends in the Curia, a guy named Cardinal Maffeo Barberini, who then a supporter of his, encouraged him to continue his work. He had opposed his condemnation in 1616. Maffeo Barberini in 1623 was elected as Pope Urban VIII. And Galileo had an audience with him in 1623. And in that audience, the Pope, Urban VIII, personally gave Galileo permission to discuss the Copernican system in his book, with the only caveat he could only discuss it as a hypothesis and not to advocate heliocentrism. And he'd been working on a book, and he told him this. And he would produce one about 10 years later, in 1632, the Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems. He means the Ptolemaic and the Copernican. And this is where things went awry. Whether in the book, it's presented as a dialogue between a guy named Salviati, who was an older acquaintance of Galileo's, and someone named Simplicius. And the defender of, well, this is partly what's at issue here, but the person who's discussing and who clearly favors the Copernican system is Salviati. The person who favors the Ptolemaic view is Simplicius. And this is a problem for several reasons. One, Simplicius is a Latin name, kind of means a fool or foolish. And Simplicius is kind of made to seem kind of dumb in the dialogue. He's someone, Simplicius, who in the course of the dialogue contradicts himself. He's caught up in his own errors, kind of comes across as a fool. And critics of his began to claim he was doing this to advocate for the Copernican system. To make matters worse, and this is something I still don't understand, no one's explained to my satisfaction, is that he actually put the words of Urban VIII into the mouth of this dialogue figure, Simplicius. Urban VIII had written a book on this, or written on this anyway. He favored the Aristotelian system. He was still, you know, in that mode. A lot of people were, as I mentioned before. And for whatever reason, he put words from his works in the mouth of people of the character who clearly, whatever his intention, got the worst of it. He clearly did that. And most historians agree that Galileo didn't do this out of malice, but he felt blindsided both by the Pope's reaction and the general reaction to his book. However, the Pope did not take this very well, and he alienated his biggest supporter, effectively, in the Curia. And in 1632, he was called to Rome to defend his writings, which he went to, by the way, willingly. He wasn't under force to do that. And so he stands trial in 1633, and he goes to Rome, and he denies that he had publicly supported the proposition that heliocentrism was true. And in response to this, if you recall, back in 1616, they'd given him an injunction not to defend the thesis, hold it as true, against him. He brought up a certificate, that certificate from Bellarmine, which totally flummoxed his inquisitors. They actually had to stop for 3 weeks to figure out what to do next. When it resumed, he insisted that he was surprised at the reaction to the book. He denied intending to give the impression that he favored the Earth's motion. And he claimed he was sorry and was ready to make amends for it. And the court accepted this, the inquisitorial court. But they were still suspicious of the denial. This is one of the main charges against him, by the way, that he had published this book maliciously. He had meant to ridicule people. And then they subjected him to a quote-unquote rigorous examination. And I mention this because I should stop here for a moment. When talking about the Inquisition, you probably have no idea what this is. The Inquisition's a court. It's a legal body in the Catholic Church to determine charges of heresy. It has its own specialized procedures. It's an area of specialized expertise, in other words, is part of this story here. And I mention that because we'll get to this in a moment. The sentence against him mentions he was subjected to a rigorous examination. That's a code, and it's a code for the idea that they interrogated him under the threat of torture. There are words for this, in the 17th century. And if you're wondering about the use of torture in investigations, it was common in Italy, not just in the church, but in 17th century law courts, civil law courts. Why? To try to gauge people's actual intents. Apparently what happened was, under interrogation, he basically said he would rather be tortured than admit to malice. He was like in his 60s at this point. And so, by all accounts, by the way, they were satisfied with that. And we have no evidence he was actually touched. And so this is probably, by the way, where the rumor he was tortured comes from. And it seemed like he was, at least apparently to Galileo, he was going to get off fairly leniently, but he didn't, for reasons that are hard to figure out. But The sentence of the Inquisition basically declared him guilty of what's called vehement suspicion of heresy. Again, this is a technical phrase. It's basically less than actual heresy. Formal heresy would be the more serious charge. It's a lesser charge, but it means we suspect we couldn't prove it effectively. We think you probably did this. In other words, they didn't totally buy his. They actually did say he answered manfully like a Catholic when he said he wasn't malicious. But they didn't buy, for example, he said he'd forgotten about the injunction in 1616 that he originally given him. They didn't quite buy that. I think it's probably the reason why they felt like he was not being totally honest with them. And so Galileo was required to recant his heliocentric ideas. He declared before them, he had this written writing, that the heliocentric system was, the idea that the sun is stationary was false and contrary to Holy Scripture. And basically they said that they could not hold, this is what the, well, I'll read the actual passage here, because we have this in front of me. The decree of 1633, so you can hear the verbiage and how this is expressed. One moment. Yeah. One second. It was on this page, yeah. We pronounce sentence and declare that you, the above mentioned Galileo, because of the things deduced in the trial and confessed by you as above, have rendered yourself, according to this holy office, vehemently suspected of heresy, namely of having held and believed a doctrine which is false and contrary to the divine and holy scriptures, that the sun is the center of the world and does not move from east to west. And I won't go through all that. We are willing to absolve you from them, provided that first, with a sincere heart and unfeigned faith in front of us, you abjure, curse, and detest the above-mentioned errors and heresies, etc., etc. So they declared this basically, you could not hold this as true because it was contrary to Holy Scripture. And that's the sentence of the Inquisition. Now, as to what happens to him, we'll talk about this more in a moment, their actual finding. He was ordered to be imprisoned. Basically, he was later commuted to house arrest. He spent his imprisonment with a friendly bishop, a friendly cardinal named Piccolomini, the Archbishop of Siena, and I think like 3 months. And then after that, he was allowed to return to his own villa near Florence, where he spent the remainder of his life under house arrest, where people basically come and go as they please. He really wasn't, again, imprisoned in any meaningful sense. He still wrote books. He published the book called The Two New Sciences. It summarized some of the work he'd done 40 years earlier. And so, again, he wasn't allowed to publish on the geocentric theory thereafter. And so one of the things I want to talk about here is, okay, by the way, there was still no agreement among scientists after his condemnation. And the reason why is because Galileo couldn't really prove his point. He couldn't mathematically prove, for example, that the sun was stationary. One of the things that he thought was real is because he had a better model for this. One of the things you have to remember about this in the 17th century is that a lot of things he was arguing, they really weren't, they kind of contradicted common sense. Earlier in 1616, when he, actually 1615, when he was arguing this point in earlier writings, his friend Bellarmine made this point, is that basically it looks like, and a lot of Aristotelian philosophers mentioned this as well, you know, if you didn't know better, like it would look like the sun is moving across the heavens. That's what it looks like to your naked eye. You have to be trained to understand otherwise. And of course, he was not banking, by the way, on observation. He was banking on mathematics. And that's why he came up with a lot of ideas that, again, it's probably one of the reasons why people weren't convinced by his defense of Copernicus, was he came up with ancillary reasons that weren't very good. The most famous one's his theory of the tides. He was trying to, you know, prove that the Earth moved, right? So how do you do that? He basically said, well, it's the motion of the Earth turning on its axis that caused the tides. The idea was that the tides, it moves around and it sort of sloshes like it's in a pan or something, the oceans. And the problem with this was obvious, is that pretty much everybody pointed this out to him, was that If that's the case, then there'd only be one tide, because of course the Earth turns on its axis once every 24 hours. The problem, as any sort of, you know, illiterate sailor could tell you, is there are two tides. There are two tides essentially. And despite this, he doubled down on it. He refused to believe it, partly because he actually said that the influence of the moon, which is actually the real cause of the tides, sounded like occult forces. In other words, it's something you couldn't mathematically prove, so it wasn't, you know, something he didn't believe. And the funny thing is, this couldn't be proved until the 19th century, mathematically speaking. What could be proved, the person who actually did prove this mathematically, was not Galileo and did end the debate on this, was Sir Isaac Newton. He's the one who brought together the ideas of Kepler, of Galileo, and his Principia Mathematica in 1687 put to rest this idea of a static heavens, effectively, and proved that. But it took, and God, by the way, I'm not sure how many people actually read the Principia Mathematica and could understand it in the 17th century, even today. It's a book full of, you know, abstruse mathematics, but my point is, it's not as if, you know, Galileo was immediately proven right in his time frame. In fact, he really couldn't be. It took time. And this is the thing to note about the progress of science. It takes time, normally. It doesn't happen to hand. He was proved right in the end, but that happens sometimes. And you can make the argument, by the way, well, I'll get to this in a second, about the actual debate. We'll talk about the larger implications in a second, but you can make the debate that the church was actually right in some ways. We'll get to that in a moment. Of course, this has been hung around the church's neck ever since. And by the way, it is true that Catholic scientists did stay away from astronomy because of this. It's true. They didn't stay away from other areas. They contributed in other areas like biology in the 17th and 18th century. It's not really true that it sort of totally deadened scientific work in the church. Again, in some ways it did, and I'd say it wouldn't. And of course, famously, John Paul II issued an apology to Galileo on behalf of the church, which, again, didn't really do any good, because it's not really about that. The people who hate the church don't care how often you apologize. They just want you to submit and give up your beliefs. But one of the reasons, by the way, if you're wondering why this myth that he was imprisoned, why this myth that he was, you know, tortured, endured, is partly because of the secrecy of the Inquisition. Urban VIII made sure he publicized the verdict of the Inquisition. He wanted people to know not to cross that line anymore, and he did that. But the records of the trials themselves weren't widely available till the late 19th century. Because, of course, the Inquisition's a law court, has these very secretive rules. It contributed to that myth, in other words, because of the nature of all this. So, that's in brief the Galileo affair. So, okay, why isn't the church to blame about all this? Why was this a good thing? Why aren't we condemning the church? Why is that not appropriate? Well, first thing I'll say here is I think we can say the Pope overreacted to Galileo a little bit. Probably seemed personally offended too much, and probably went a little bit overboard. I think that's fairly safe to say. Urban VIII was a good pope for the most part. Had a real problem with nepotism, but otherwise a good pope. I think you can say, the political response to this, wasn't the best. But more than that, you can make the argument that the church was actually right. To not necessarily to condemn Galileo, but to say basically he shouldn't teach that theory as true. Why? It hadn't been proved. And the church was right that it hadn't been proved at that point. In fact, just to read something from you, this is a letter that Robert Bellarmine wrote, a famous letter to a Carmelite named Foscarini, a guy who's a supporter of Galileo. It was 1615. This is before this all blows up. But he was kind of skeptical of Galileo's theory, and he has this to say about it. He said, this is, you know, Bellarmine talking about the theory of Copernican theory. "I say that if there were a true demonstration that the sun is at the center of the world and the earth is in the third heaven, and that the sun does not circle the earth, but the earth circles the sun, then one would have to proceed with great care in explaining the scriptures that appear contrary, and say rather that we do not understand them than that what is demonstrated is false. But I will not believe that there is such a demonstration until it is shown me." Nor is it the same to demonstrate that by assuming the sun to be at the center and the earth in heaven, one can save the appearances, and to demonstrate that in truth the sun is at the center and the earth is in the heaven, for I believe that the first demonstration may be available. I have great doubts about the second. In any case, one must not abandon the Holy Scripture as interpreted by the Holy Fathers. The point was, he says Galileo hadn't really demonstrated it. And in fact, that's actually true. What he had was a better model. And that's true, he did. His model, the geocentric model, Copernican model was better. And it turned out to be true later on. But he really couldn't demonstrate it at the time. And you could make the case that people like Bellarmine were more, you know, properly skeptical about its truth than Galileo. Galileo went too far. He went beyond the scientific consensus, really. And there was, again, the conflict over this didn't end with his condemnation. Ended with Newton, as I mentioned before. But even beyond that, and again, you have, and again, I mentioned this before, there's also this conflict of expertise going on, right? That the churches seems to be kind of, actually the theologians seem to be kind of wanting to defend their turf, right? But there's also something bigger going on here. And I refer to, and if you have read this already, I don't know how big of a surprise this is to you, but I'm influenced by this, on this topic by the late Austrian philosopher, Paul Feyerabend. And Feyerabend was an agnostic, but he was a philosopher of science. And he saw the Galileo affair as a conflict, not between religious, you know, expertise and scientific expertise, between specialist expertise and generalist expertise. That is to say, you know, someone who has new ideas, you know, specialized knowledge, versus people who their role is to see how this new knowledge relates to the whole of society, what impact it might have on all society. And he sees in his, he wrote a brief essay you can find on the internet, it's called Galileo and the Tyranny of Truth, that these experts who make these claims that, well, our expertise demands that we sort of reshape society to fit these new findings, should take a back seat to people whose responsibility is for the whole of society and not merely for this one limited area of expertise. I'm going to read you a little bit of Feyerabend's essay. It's a good one here. This is him talking about, because he's talking about, he basically says Galileo is the first type of expert. The church takes a position that thought was similar to his second view, the generalist idea of expertise. This is what he says. Quote, astronomical knowledge, according to the church, was important and was actively pursued by some of its members. But the models which the astronomers produced could not be related to reality without further considerations. This very point was made in the first part of a famous letter Cardinal Bellarmine wrote to Paolo Antonio Foscarini, a Carmelite monk from Naples, who had inquired about the reality of the Copernican system. Bellarmine writes, this is the same letter I read from, he says, it seems to me your reverence and Signor Galileo act prudently when you content yourselves with speaking hypothetically and not absolutely. To say that on the supposition of the Earth's movement and the sun's quiescence, all the celestial appearances are explained better by the theory of eccentrics and epicycles is to speak with excellent good sense and to run no risk whatever. Such a manner of speaking is enough for a mathematician. But to affirm that the sun, and in very truth, is at the center of the universe and only rotates on its axis without going from east to west is a very dangerous attitude, and one calculated not only to arouse all scholastic philosophers and theologians, but also to injure our holy faith by contradicting the scriptures. Unquote. Feyerabend goes on, in modern terms, astronomers may assert that one model has predictive advantages over another model, but they are mistaken when they assert that the model is, therefore, a faithful image of reality. This sensible principle is part and parcel of modern science. Approximations are commonplaces in the sciences. They are used because they facilitate calculations in a restricted domain. Their symmetry properties frequently differ from those of the underlying theory. Hence, if the theory is assumed to correspond to reality, the approximations cannot correspond to reality in the same sense. Also, many theories are developed as steps toward a more satisfactory but as a yet unknown view. They may be successful, but the very purposes for which they are introduced forbids us to draw realistic consequences from them. Even a formerly perfect theory with surprising predictive power may fail when regarded as a direct expression of reality, unquote. And that last part's the big thing I want to mention there, is that scientist whose models are very elegant. They give us, some sort of, ability to predict certain things about nature, don't provide direct access to reality ever. They're just models. And the reason why they don't, by the way, is because specialized expertise is specialized. Their expertise comes from focus on one very narrow part of the world. That would be mathematics, right? To give you what I'm saying here is that basically modern science gives us really, really accurate knowledge about one very limited aspect of the physical world. Doesn't tell us anything else. The philosopher Bertrand Russell wrote a book called The Outline of Philosophy, and he put it this way, unquote, quoting him, physics is mathematical, not because we know so much about the physical world, because we know so little. It is only its mathematical properties that we can discover. For the rest, our knowledge is negative, unquote. Its competence is limited by the nature of its frame of reference because of the narrowness of its scope. Why am I mentioning all this? Because one way you could see the church as being, it's usually seen as a condemning progress and all this stuff. Another way you could see it is the way that Feyerabend saw it. But it was, and Bellarmine's the church at its best. Again, I'm not saying Urban VIII reacted the best way. He didn't. Or Galileo's critics were all selfless. They weren't. But Bellarmine's caution and skepticism could be seen as more properly responsible way to approach things like scientific truth. Because he, and this is the big point here, is that we have to be responsible how new knowledge affects all of society. Now, you may say, well, that's ridiculous, this stuff is true. And by the way, I'm all for that. I think you should think of truth first. But you do have to see how it relates to the whole of things. And I'll give you a modern parallel, by the way. Well, I'll give you two, actually. before you rush to judgment because of the latest findings of some sort of scientist or something, one very touchy subject is that of the issue of genetics and intelligence. This is the idea that intelligence is heritable and inheritable by different groups of humans, that is, by race. This is a very, very, very explosive topic for obvious reasons. And most of the, as far as I'm aware of it, most of the actual work on this tends in the direction that, yeah, it is heritable and it is distributed differently by race. And of course, the response to this should not be, okay, automatically, I guess that proves everybody's an idiot or something, or races are now worth less because they're less intelligent. The response to that is, okay, this is only one measure, one genetic measure of a human being. Not only that there are other measures, but it doesn't measure the whole of the human person. A person is not a pure intelligence. He is not his pure reasoning skills. But I think our obsession with a certain type of expert knowledge has led us to believe that. The idea of an expert says something, they can sort of, has the idea that this is the myth I'm talking about, by the way, in the title of my episode. The myth of modern expertise is there's an expert out there who can solve all our problems. Once he finds the right formula, we're all going to go to heaven or something. Or we're all going to do this, or we're all going to do that. It's going to solve everything, right? And what's problematic about this is that, of course, we have seen in the last couple of years what happens when experts go beyond their expertise to try to impose their ideas on the rest of society on the basis of that. And yes, I am referring to the pandemic. that is example A of, and I've seen this, by the way, I'm not just criticizing scientists here or medical personnel. I see this in every walk of life. Somebody gets some expert knowledge, they think that they have the right to opine on everything, even though they have no idea what they're talking about. And so this sort of idea of especially specialist expertise run amok. And this is the other thing I'm mentioning here. Somebody has to have a concern for the whole, which nobody seems to do anymore. We don't live in a Catholic society anymore, and the church has certainly given up this. I actually wrote an article about this in Crisis Magazine, how church leaders and theologians seem to chop up the church's faith into those little itty bits that they like, that seem to be, to fit with the findings of modern specialists in psychology and sociology, and make it fit that stuff, which I think is a betrayal of the faith. And of course, the church leaders want to sound intelligent, and they're terrified. They're terrified of being made to look bad in the eyes of the secular world. And so that's why we come back to bring it back to the end of this with the myth of Galileo, is that Galileo is the archetypal sort of specialized expert. And I think it's something, you know, people in the church should think about more here, right? And again, you can go on. Again, people, again, they read this backwards. Like, it wasn't clear Galileo was right in 1633. Doesn't mean they should go around condemning people like that or doing things. Again, they didn't do a whole lot, really. But it means that their caution, their defense of the faith. And again, they jumped the gun. There are other ways of interpreting scripture. But they weren't just thinking about that. They were thinking about how a literal interpretation of the Bible and casting doubt on it would affect everything else. Not just the people, the Aristotelians who were banking on that to support theories, but also the common people. I think they were genuinely concerned about that. And someone should be, right? It may be very well true that people's intelligence differs by genetic inheritance, by race. Somebody has to be responsible for making sure that's not abused. That's the whole purpose of it. And given the context of the time, I think the church had a lot of reason to be worried about that. It's also why we in the modern world, again, this is hard for people. Again, I have, history is not really much of a sort of specialized occupation in a lot of ways, but I have a PhD, I have that stuff, I have that in my background. I think people have learned to be, you know, skeptical of this. And I'm not saying specialized expertise is bad. Science is definitely not bad. It's definitely good. I'm not saying you shouldn't be a valued part of society, but I think it has gone way too far in the other direction. They have way too much influence. They have way too much, power. And I don't think they should have that much. There's a reason why their specialized expertise shouldn't be given that. And it should be something, again, a democratic society, in theory at least, everyone should have some input on and not be allowed to have society or the church imposed on just because some expert says so. And despite the fact that I admire Galileo, I've come to see that in some ways what he represents and what the modern world represents is a little bit of an imbalance. It's an imbalance, right? There nobody thinks about in terms of the whole of society. And I think that's probably a real problem, not just for society, but for the church itself. Anyway, that is this version of this talk on Galileo, his trial, his condemnation. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got something out of it. I hope you learned to think a little bit differently by listening to this. Again, if you like the podcast, please tell some people about it. Tell a friend, go subscribe on Spotify for podcasters, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, wherever you listen. Go like us on Facebook, go to YouTube and subscribe there. You can also find us again on the web, churchcontroversies.com. And yes, if you'd like to become a patron, you can go to Patreon. We have a Patreon account, but mostly just to help spread the word. It will help us, help me very much. And next episode will drop fairly soon for patrons. That'll be the next episode in our series on Latinization. And the next one for everybody will probably be another week or a couple weeks, actually. And that'll be, I've been promising this one. This is the one on the Pearson Integrated Humanities Program. It's coming. I've just been busy. But be on the lookout for that stuff. And thank you everyone for listening again. God bless you all. Have a great week, and you'll be hearing from me soon. Take care.